Oh, I don't think I need to tell you after what Carol just read that I don't have to ask you, do you want the good news first or the bad news? I am going to start out with a story, though, that kind of came this summer after I knew I was going to speak, and I thought it applied, but first maybe I'll add to the bad news by letting you in on something that I see as kind of a problem amongst our teens. It's a temptation that they're facing all the time, and I think we need to be warned about it and be aware of it, and that temptation is Taco Bell. And that's what leads me to my story, because I see a lot of looks like, what? That leads me to my story. I have a really good friend at the bank. He's a good Christian friend. He's also a loan officer like myself, and he has a teenage son. And I know some people sitting right over here that are going to be able to identify with this story, Brian and Emily. But anyway, this teenage son went just after school was out this past year, and he went and spent the night with another teenager north of St. Louis. And as teenage boys do, they stayed up pretty much the whole night. And after maybe, at the most, a couple hours sleep, my friend's son said, I'm hungry. And apparently nothing in the friend's house was going to satisfy that hunger. And he said, I'm driving to Taco Bell to get something for breakfast. After just, if it was 2 hours sleep, it would be the most that they could figure that he had. So he takes off from north of St. Louis, and he drives to the Ithaca Taco Bell. That was my first question, was Ithaca Taco Bell? We have a Taco Bell in Elma. Anyway, he drives to the Ithaca Taco Bell, and he pulls in, and they're closed. So either that Taco Bell doesn't serve breakfast, or he got there a little early. It was the wee hours of the morning, and they were closed. So he takes off, turns around, gets back on the freeway, heading back home towards St. Louis, and promptly falls asleep, sound asleep. Ends up going off the freeway on the left side, shortly after getting on the right side, and wakes up abruptly in the median, does a quick inventory of himself, and finds that he's still alive, and that was pretty much the extent of it. The car had some damage, but he made it through that, and as my friend was telling me the story, my first thought was, wow, man, I guess we just call that a momentary lapse in judgment by your son. I said, but you know what? That's a teenager for you. And then we kept talking about it, and I'm like, not sure we can limit momentary lapses of judgment to teenagers. We can't. In this case, well, saying that momentary lapses in judgment are limited to teenagers would be like saying that succumbing to temptation is limited to teenagers. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. In this case, he was fine. Nobody else was in the car with him. No other cars were involved. So, you know, everything worked out that way. The police told my friend and his wife that they could tell he was a good kid, and I can tell you he was a good kid. I know the kid. He's a good kid. He didn't get belligerent or exacerbate the situation or anything like that, but I'm telling you, that's not always the case when it comes to temptation, like with the case we're looking at today. I remember a couple months ago, I remember very well when we were talking about Steve going on sabbatical, and we were starting to fill in the dates of when we would speak, and I remember thinking, well, July 26th works for me. Oh, how naive are you? That works for me. Right, Andy? Short end of the stick, she said. So anyway, I remember thinking about that, and then I find out, you know, according to the schedule for the summer, hey, you're talking about David and Bathsheba. And I'm like, I'm what? Okay. How in the world am I going to put a positive spin on something that I personally see as one of the absolute worst events in the entire Bible? You just heard what Carol read. Did you get any good out of that? I don't know. I'm thinking that maybe let's decide next year I'll talk about the Israelites being taken captive into Babylon, and the year after that I'll go with the beheading of John the Baptist. Let's get those scheduled right now. I'll be ready for those. Anyway, David, a man after God's own heart, that's a title that he has. We know that he has that title, is tempted and has a serious momentary lapse in judgment. serious momentary lapse in judgment that kind of snowballs as we see. Now, this whole summer, we've been given an opportunity to see and to understand how David received and attained that title, Man After God's Own Heart. It's already been 6 weeks, but 6 weeks ago, Steve was talking about how Samuel was given the task of finding the next king after Saul. So Samuel went to the house of Jesse, was checking, you know, through all the sons, and even Samuel, who was a prophet that knew God very well, he was looking at the older, bigger, stronger brothers, which you'd think he'd understand after big, strong Saul, that probably wasn't the way to go, but he was. And what did God say to Samuel? Man looks at the outer appearance, but God looks at the heart. And then 3 weeks ago, we hear the story that we love, the David and Goliath story. We get to hear that a lot. And David just can't understand why Saul and the troops are so afraid. And he says, with God in our camp, we can't possibly lose. That shows you right there that he has a heart of God. And then we know about how when Saul is trying to kill David all the time in his reign, and David has a couple chances to kill Saul, and he can't do it because he's too loyal and he's too honorable. He's a man after God's own heart. So then how do we explain and deal with what goes on in 2 Samuel chapter 11? That's a question I've been pondering for many weeks. So anyway, going back to the text, we see that David, it says one evening he's walking around on the roof of the palace. Now that's hard for us to comprehend right now. How many of you walk around on your roof when you can't sleep? And that's just a strange one for us to see anyway, but that's the way it was back in those days. He had sent Joab, his number one general, off to war with the troops. And it says right here distinctly, it says it, in the spring, when kings go off to war, David's in the palace. So David didn't go off to war, even though it says that's when they do it. And he can't sleep one night or something. He's walking around on the roof. He's apparently, you know, restless. And I think he's idle a little bit. You know the saying about the idle mind being the devil's workshop? That's what I see going on right here. And he looks down at a lower roof, and he sees a woman bathing. And it says right here in the text that she's beautiful. Now, for you who see that text, and it gives you an idea of what she must look like, if you'd like, I could give you an actual more lifelike idea of what she looked like by having my wife stand up. Stand up. Hey, that's what I think of when I see what it says right there. It's that lady right there. So I thought I'd share that with everybody. It doesn't look like she's going to stand up. So I'm just going to move on from here. Anyway, David sees a woman bathing on another roof in another part of the palace, and he's immediately overcome by temptation. And I want to tell you, just to make this clear, you've heard it before, but I'm going to say it again. Temptation in and of itself is not sin. Temptation is not sin. The devil will throw temptation at us all the time. Jesus was tempted in the wilderness. Let's just get that clear right now. What David was given the moment that he saw Bathsheba bathing was an opportunity to end it right now before an unfortunate chain of events happens. Walk away, David. Go like this. Say, shouldn't have seen that. Should not have seen that. And walk away. Men are very visually stimulated. They are. And what does David do? He looks, he stares, he lusts. Sadly, he commits adultery eventually and commits murder to cover that up. So we saw very clearly right there what happens if you let temptation go too far. You go down in the text and you can see a second opportunity for David to end the chain of events. What David says when he sees her, at first he says, hey, Tell me about who that might be right down there in apartment 103C. Who is that? And there's a person that says, that's Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And I could just imagine the tone of this guy's voice is, surely, King David, you're not thinking what I think you're thinking. And this is significant for us, because there's another part later on in this book where Eliam and Uriah are listed in an elite group called David's Mighty Men. I know Paul knows that. David's Mighty Men. There's others of you who might know that too. This is an elite group. These are warriors and counselors that David has chosen to be in this group of David's Mighty Men. What in the world happened to the loyalty that David used to display under King Saul that he would go this far with Eliam's daughter and Uriah's wife? I'll tell you what's happening right here. This is my opinion. After reading this and studying this, at that moment, David decides, I'm king, and I'll do whatever I want. And here's where I can't help but thinking over and over, and I've thought about this before. If you catch an early 1 Samuel, maybe later part of Judges, the people, the Israelite people, are over and over saying, we need a king. We need a king. All these other people have kings. All these other countries have kings. We need a king. And how does God answer that several times? You don't need a king. You have me. I will have judges to govern you and look over, watch over you. You really don't need a physical king. Might this be one reason why God told them that? Because even a man after God's own heart becomes king. And he does, unlike our teenager at the beginning of the story, he does become belligerent. And he does exacerbate the situation. He takes Bathsheba as his own, as Andy so delicately tiptoed through with the kids. Takes Bathsheba as his own. And she becomes pregnant. And immediately, David realizes that he might want to fix the situation that he's gotten himself into. And as we know, that usually works about 0% of the time. How does he go about trying to fix the situation? He tells Joab, his number one general, to bring in Uriah and give him a leave from the war, from the battle, have him come in and go to his home and lay with his wife. And then that way everybody can think it's Uriah's child, and Uriah can think that it's Uriah's child. But what's the deal with Uriah? He's too honorable and loyal. He says, I can't be comfortable and sleep with my wife and be in my house when all the other troops are out there on the front lines, when the ark is out there and Joab, my commander's out there. I can't do that. Now, do you think right about at that point, David's nose is really being rubbed in what he's doing? Because David was considered very honorable and very loyal and now has kind of fallen off a cliff with this. So Uriah does not do it, and he won't do it. Given two opportunities to do it, and he won't do it. And I believe, for me, this is a third chance for David to end this deadly chain of events. Pull Uriah to the side and say, here's what has happened. Here's what I've done. Please forgive me. Pick up the pieces as they will. I don't know. But at least if he does that here, Uriah gets to live. But the final heinous act is carried out. So, for me, I come to this question again. How can somebody that's considered a man after God's own heart come to this point? How can this happen with somebody that we know, you know, is a man after God's own heart? The questions that I came up with right here are, were we deceived by David? Was David really a bad guy? Was God wrong about David? Does God make mistakes like that? The answer to those four questions, no, 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 and no. He does not lose his title as man after God's own heart. I can show you in Hebrews chapter 11. Many of you know that Hebrews 11 is considered the faith chapter. I can show you in there that David's name is mentioned among an all-star list of Old Testament heroes. He's there. That wasn't erased because this happened. It's still there. But David had that serious, serious momentary lapse in judgment. And it snowballed. Let's just put it that way. But I want to start making the transition now from the bad news to the good news. Because this stuff, it happens with humans. Jeremiah 17:9. You know what that says? Talk about adding to the bad news before I transition to the good news. Jeremiah 17:9 says, the human heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? It's what Jeremiah 17:9 says. Who can really understand what the human heart is capable of doing, even when they know God? That's what it says. But we can't hang on that verse or we will be discouraged. Because even though God has that in His Word, that verse right there, God loves us. And God offers His forgiveness to us. And I want to make my transition by having three points that I want to have up here. Three conclusions that I've come to after reading through this stuff and wondering how we were going to come to a point where we get something positive. But I knew God would make sure that we did, that we walked away with something positive. Point number one, we as God's people, we as Christians, will still be tempted and we will always be tempted. Okay? It's in the devil's job description. He knows each of us, not the way God does, believe me, but the devil, this is his domain. He knows you. He knows what tempts you. And as I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking about this little excerpt that I want to read to you from a book that a lot of us in this church have been looking at, whether in small group settings or maybe Sunday school or something. But a lot of you have read through this, and it's a book called The Good and Beautiful God. And this page came to me as I was thinking about this, and I just want to read this to you because I thought it was very interesting. And for some, maybe you've never really heard it this way, but this is what it says in The Good and Beautiful God. Christians can sin. That's what it says with quotations. Christians can sin. This does not mean they ought to sin. We were not made for sin. We have died to it. But we certainly can and do sin. As Christians, we are not under the law. No set of rules or list of do's and don'ts define a Christian. And guilt is an ineffective motivator over time. But that does not mean we can do whatever we want when we want. That does not mean that. Paul would say, God forbid. That doesn't mean that. Paul says, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are beneficial. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything, especially sin. I am free to make choices about what I do and do not do. But pay attention to this. Those choices should be made in light of who I am, not to determine who I am. I am one in whom Christ dwells, and that should guide my decisions. Will this activity be beneficial to me? Will that activity enslave me? These are the questions we now ask. I thought that was very helpful for what I was talking about because we will always be tempted. So the question becomes, how far will we go in that temptation? Here's where I walk the tightrope of something that came to my mind. I want to talk to you about when a smaller sin can become a deeper and more serious sin. Good, I got by that couple seconds where nobody jumped up and said, small sin, they're all sins. Sin is sin. Thank you for not doing that. I understand that. Sin is sin. But I'm going to tell you right now that a smaller sin can become a more serious sin in a hurry after the temptation has hatched into sin. Okay? We have the most perfect example of that in our text today. David had a chance to, even after he got to the point where he was lusting after Bathsheba, wondering, who is this? And how quickly could I get her up to my room? By saying, oh, wow, what did I just let happen to me? And asking God for forgiveness right there. A smaller sin is when you and your relationship with God are affected by that sin. No one else. You didn't bring anyone else into the snare. David could have done that. But in this case, he didn't. I want to read from James chapter 1. You can turn there with me if you want, but I will be reading James chapter 1, verses 13 through 15, just to give you an idea of how sin can become more serious sin when we give in to temptation. Verses 13 through 15, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. That looks like it's talking about what happened with David. Right there. And that's the stuff that happens when we let a smaller sin grow. Or when we cross the line of temptation, sin, and it becomes more serious. Okay? So, that's point number one. We will always be tempted. Point number two, just really, really good news, guys. God will always provide a way out, and sometimes more than one. He will always provide a way out. God knows us. He understands what we're going through as humans. Let's go right to 1 Corinthians 10:13. I love this verse. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. If you don't take that escape route, it's not God's fault. And if you want to get belligerent and exacerbate situations, go ahead and say God never provided you a way out, because he did. He did. Once, twice, three times in David's case, or more. He will always give you a way out. He loves us. He understands us. He accepts us back when we sin. Always gives us escape routes. And then number three, God's grace is always greater than our sin. Now we're to the really good news, right? The really good news. God's grace is always greater than our sin. No matter what we've done, God will be there to help us pick up the pieces and forgive us. Now, David, in this case, he remained king for a long time. We know that. But Ben's going to talk to you next week about some consequences that David faces through this, and they are very serious consequences. Because rest assured, when you sin, there will be consequences for that sin. That's just the way it is. There are consequences for that sin. But you know what? God still proves that he loves us over and over. When I think of consequences, of course, the story that I start out with is a kid driving a car, you know, and he's tempted by Taco Bell and everything. We're not even talking about the same things, of course. I just thought the story kind of did relate in many ways. But I'll tell you what, that kid had consequences. There was a huge ticket. They had to write a ticket for that. And he didn't have the money to pay for it, so guess who got to pay it? I had to do a loan to his dad to pay it. No, just kidding. Just kidding. But, I mean, and then the insurance costs are going to go up, and then there's that trust factor with his parents. You know, we're not sure whether to let you have the car at night or not. You know, lots of things happen to affect that family through this, you know. The whole time, I knew right when he was telling me the story, like, wow, this is a really good kid, right? This is a really good kid, and things happen like this. But in his case, there are consequences, and if we sin, there will be consequences for our sin. But the really, really good news is God loves us and forgives us if we ask him. And I want to throw in here a point for us, that God forgives all the others around us too that make those mistakes, okay? Sometimes it's easy for us to focus on some ways that others around us have sinned maybe and to shun them a little bit, point fingers at them and stuff like that. That's really not our job. I've had struggles with that through the years myself. You know, God forgives me and he loves me. Well, you know what? He forgives and loves the others around you too. So our job here is to restore people around us. Our job is to restore them. Now, I will tell you too that I, in judgment, read 2 Samuel 11. Don't you? David, you're a man after God's own heart. I cannot believe this. It's easy to do. I've done it with other things in Scripture too. Those Israelites were just idiots complaining all the time. I would not do that. Oh, okay. All right. So we can read things like that in judgment. So think about how we, you know, the people around us sometimes, we need to make sure that we restore. And immediately what came to my mind too here is Peter himself. Jesus was basically with his disciples. Hey, who do people say that I am? And they give their answers. Well, who do you say I am? Peter, I know, you are the Messiah, you're the Christ, you're the Son of the living God. And within a couple days, Peter denies three times that he even knows him. Denies that he even knows him. We would never do that, would we? And then Jesus, when he's arisen, goes, kind of has a private little meeting with Peter and gently but firmly reinstates Peter three times. Question, has anyone here ever had to be reinstated when you blew it? I could raise my hand and keep it up there for a long, long time. Of course. Had to be reinstated when I blew it. But you know, God looks at us. He loves us. He never stops loving us. Just like my friend and his wife never once stopped loving their son for doing something so crazy. It's a lot like that. Andy mentioned something like that too with her son, bopping his brother on the head. But God never does. And what he does is he looks down and he sees us through the cross and the shed blood of Jesus. And with all of our blemishes and all our bumps and all our bruises, he actually sees us as flawless. There's got to be